Welcome back to a very special podcast episode. Today, I'm joined by Jawala Singh and Simran Kaur, and we're discussing Mahalla 9's new calendar for 2023, all about women in Sikh. Before we get into the podcast, if you want to get your hands on one of these beautiful calendars that includes 13 original artworks printed on B3 large format, wire-bound with a strong backboard, delivery available within the UK and worldwide, so whether you're in Australia, India, or America, we've got you covered. All you need to do is go to mahalla9.com and use the discount code RAMBLINGS to knock off 10%. You can also find the link and the discount code in the description below. With that out of the way, let's have a quick look at what we're discussing in today's podcast.
We have paintings that they have held in their lineage for many years, since the times of the gurus,
What the calendar covers.
For example, Mata Nanaki, Mata Golan, etc. Why were these stories not told to us growing up?
Who is involved?
A group of artists now as well, both from our own community and out in the community.
Where did the stories come from?
So we're using pre-colonial sources.
And a whole lot more, so you may want to watch this until the end.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seat.
2 years ago, they released the Mahalla Nova calendar, and it was based on the life of Gurudev Bahadurji Maharaj. And they're all commissioned paintings that went into the calendar, and people kept them. You could keep them as like memorabilia to hang in your house. So it was really successful. I mean, people to this day still have the calendars up, people have the paintings up, which is really good. And because of that success, the community kind of brought forward the idea of a women's calendar based on the women of the GOM. And that's kind of where we are now. And it's brought together a group of artists now as well, both from our own community and out of the community. So we've kind of outreached a bit more this time, and we've got a very diverse amount of stories that aren't talked about, that probably most people haven't heard of, being brought into the light by the research done by Jawala and another one of our researchers. So yeah, it's going to be a really good calendar that's coming out. So that's what's going on right now.
Why was the decision made to make the theme solely on women?
Well, in my exploration of a pre-colonial text through Suraj Prakash and on the Suraj podcast, one thing that became apparent in the feedback that I was getting is that the stories include such fine detail and such interesting stories about women. And why were these stories of women, for example, Mata Nanaki, Mata Golan, etc., why were these stories not told to us growing up? So we decided that in looking at stories from the pre-colonial text, what we wanted to do is dig out these stories and present them in a new way, have them fashioned visually by artists and commissioned for this calendar project. So that's kind of where the idea came from, to kind of present these stories that have not been told, that have been kind of left unnoticed for many years.
One thing that is quite interesting is this argument over idol worship and paintings that depict in particularly our gurus, but like, how does that idea then work across what you guys are currently doing and actually what the first calendar did, because that did depict Gurudev Bahadurji.
For some people in the community, there's a certain uncomfortable kind of perception related to depicting the gurus visually in paintings. And we know through pre-colonial texts that this was a tradition, that the Guru Har Gobind had a portrait commission. This is referenced in texts. We have from the lineages of Bhai Rupa, Bidhi Chand, the Sordis of Kartarpur, etc., we have paintings that they have held in their lineage for many years, since the times of the gurus, So for example, Guru Gobind Singh in the Bhai Rupa collection. And we also have visual art that has not been whitewashed, thank God, in some gurdwaras that have remained, like Baba Atal Gurdwara, in the gurdwaras in Pakistan. Through some of the research in the books that have been produced recently, we actually have photos of those frescoes. So we know that this was a tradition in the 1800s and the 1700s and even prior before that of depicting the gurus. Yet there's a certain level of thought that, oh, perhaps this could lead into then idol worship. And that's where we want to kind of think about this more deeply, and the fact that, you know, is this idol worship, or is this just a means to evoke memory? And that's where that you see in the gurdwaras of the past and the frescoes, that the paintings were depicting stories of Guru Nanak, for example, let's say in the images of Baba Atal. And those images then evoke the memory, the stories of the actions of the guru. And they are not in a way that present, you know, the actual kind of appearance of the guru, and, you know, in that sense, then kind of make people bow down to those images. But In the same way, we can think, is the body of the guru, the guru, if one were to meet Guru Har Gobind, Guru Gobind Singh Sahib, is actually his physical form the guru? Because we know those physical forms change, right? So it's a different way of thinking about what is the guru, and just different ways of connecting with the guru. And we know that these ways of connecting with the guru have been part of the tradition for a long time. It seems to be that since the early 1900s, people have become uncomfortable with this on account of kind of differentiating from Indic thought related to Murti Puja or worshiping of idols. Yet at the same time, we have to think about how can we convey these stories of the gurus? How can we convey their actions through visual representation? And when we think about even language, when we think about poetry, poetry itself is a connection of different strings of words, using different, you know, poetic devices, you know, and colorful imagery to paint, you know, an image on the canvas of the mind, right? It's conveying imagery that you're internally seeing, right? So in that way, you know, we can think of them as alike, visual imagery and poetic imagery. So what we wanted to do with this project is kind of give space for upcoming artists, amazing artists like Simran Kaur and others to kind of paint these stories of the Matama, other mothers, of the community, in a way that we can then tell these stories to the community.
So before we move on to the next question, Simran, I just like to get some kind of idea of like what your perspective is as an artist when it comes to depicting not just the gurus but also just other people from Sikh history, and obviously like your involvement in this project.
I think as an artist, it's kind of your, there's a responsibility behind kind of bringing forward stories that haven't been told before. And actually a conversation I had with Javala just before this podcast, we talked about how painting and creating visual images is a universal language. So you're not just speaking to your own community, you're speaking to the world. And these images are not just going to us, that the whole world will see them. And so you're also bringing that into the fold, that you're telling their stories out to everyone, really. And as an artist, you have the power to, I guess, change how we see the women of the Qom for the next generations, and bring forward stories that are not just about kind of the warrior spirit and about being the mothers or being on the sideline of the gurus. You have stories that tell you that you can see, you can learn more about your guru, sorry, through their perspective. So you can understand themes of detachment, understand themes of longing, understand themes of liberation through these stories that you wouldn't hear generally growing up or in kind of the fold now. So it's, I guess, as an artist in this project, you have that responsibility where you are, and not really a weight, but you have that kind of, I don't know what the word is to describe it, but you have,
I guess in a sense, you're conveying research that maybe perhaps, like, so you're universalizing something that might not be in English, that might be in poetry, that might be difficult to get hold of or to read. Like, you're taking stories, or as you were saying, like, you're taking hidden gems that people like Javala and others are researching and bringing to the forefront. And then you as an artist and the others involved are taking that and going, okay, how can I create, as Javala was just mentioning, like, this is forming an image. You guys are literally painting that image. Like, you're turning it into something that we can all see, and then don't have to necessarily then read, I don't know, whatever it is that has evoked or created that image.
Yeah, you're definitely right. And it's also like a lot of, before we kind of came forward with the project, a lot of messages that we were getting from the community were like, oh, we want this calendar will be something that we'll keep in our house, our daughters will look up to it, or like the our kids are going to look up to it. And kids necessarily are not learning hardcore Punjabi or not learning hardcore other languages that are written within different manuscripts. So you have images that they'll look at and understand stories that then they'll grow up with, maybe do their own Khoj when they're older learning these stories. So it's a pathway, really. You're creating a platform for them to then move forward with those stories.
No, definitely. So Javala, I just want to get an idea then of where are these stories coming from, and what do these sources tell us about Sikh women in history?
So we're using pre-colonial sources, largely Suraj Prakash, the Gurbilas texts from the 18th century. And these are fascinating because they are depicting the stories of the women in a different way, in a way that has not been affected through the colonial period in Punjab. So in the way that they're describing what they're wearing, their social interaction that's happening at that time, we're trying to dig those stories out and present it in a new light. And so we have a lot of different stories from Mai Pago to Mata Kivi, Mata Nanaki. The range of stories all depict different aspects in which the women then contributed and helped the community. And what we're trying to do through this is to show that this is a diverse range of interaction that the women of the community had. And it wasn't just whether, you know, one way in which we like to nowadays see women of old is just as warriors and essentially as kind of providing material or martial assistance for the Singhs in battle. But there's a whole range of ways that the women were helping, whether it's Mata Kivi helping in the Langar, whether it's Mata Saibdeva, who's sitting on the Takat, who's sitting on the throne in Delhi for the community that's coming there and bowing down to her. And she's commanding, okay, we need people in Amritsar. So she sends Bhai Mani Singh, Shaheed to Amritsar to kind of organize the community there. Like, she is the chess player that's organizing the Pant in that way, right? So you have this different range of interaction. And like Simran Kaur was saying, then the women of our future generations, when they look to these stories, they can see that there's not just one path for them. Just as we as Singhs, you don't have stories of, you know, the Khalsa, the martial Singhs who are fighting in battle, but we also have Bhai Kanhaiya as well, who's given out medical assistance as well. And both of those are acceptable. You know, it's not, nobody in the community would say, oh, Bhai Kanhaiya should have picked up the sword and fought. You know, we know that there are multiple ways to engage with the community. And we just know that from our traditions of Kirtan to Katha to Seva, etc., right? So we're trying to kind of present a diverse range of interaction.
One thing that you touched upon was the sources are pre-colonial. Why is that important in terms of, I guess, what has colonialism done to our current understanding of women in our community?
I think in many ways, especially in the ways that the women are depicted and kind of the social interaction that the Matama have with the gurus and the community, I think there's a way in which that gets looked at through kind of a Victorian lens. And that kind of changes the way in which we engage with the stories. And this is a very difficult thing to kind of undo once this lens gets put over our eyes as a community. So one way that we're trying to do that is trying to dig out stories from the pre-colonial where they were looking at these stories in a different light. So for example, these stories about Mata Saibdeva, you know, the mother of the Khalsa, who is basically the organizer of the entire Panth. She is the commander, she's the general, right? These type of stories have been largely suppressed. And especially when you see her own hukamname, so her own commandments that she's sending out to different communities, those types of imagery of her writing out these hukamname, these have largely been erased. And even to the extent that we have changed her own name, largely most of the community calls her Mata Saib Kaur, but in her own handwriting, she says her name is Mata Saib Devi and sings out of respect, say Saib Deva. Devi and Deva, essentially the same thing. So if we can't even say the name of Mata Saib Deva correctly, then that just shows you to the extent that we have suppressed her history.
Just before we move on, and I asked Simran about the image that she's creating for the calendar, I just want to ask, when you say suppressed, what is behind all of that? Is it a kind of a intentional suppressed, like what's behind it that is occurring? Or essentially, for argument's sake, even the name change, like what's the mentality behind changing the name from Devi or Deva to Kaur?
Well, largely this is to kind of overlay the Khalsa-centric kind of martial viewpoint of the Pant over top of all the Matama, over top of all the mothers of the Pant. And in that way, it really cuts out a large part of their story. And to paint a fuller picture, what we're trying to do is tend to show the different aspects of these women and their engagement with the Bant. So in kind of looking at, for example, the story of Bibi Bani and Bibi Amuro. So nowadays it's known that in many Gurdwaras, Sikh women aren't allowed to perform kirtan, but there's stories of Bibi Amuro, who is the daughter of Guru Angad Devji, and in her recitation of Gurbani every morning, it drew her uncle Amar Das to Guru Angad Devji, and then Guru Amar Das became the next guru through that. So it's through actually the recitation, the kirtan of Bibi Amuro, that we have the third guru, which is just something to think about. And many people don't know that was the case. Also, when you look at Jassa Singh Ahluwalia's mother, she's not in this calendar, but just another story that gets overlooked is that Jassa Singh Ahluwalia's mother would perform kirtan. This is mentioned in Prachin Panth Prakash by Ratan Singh Pangu, that Jassa Singh Ahluwalia's mother would perform kirtan for the Dal Khalsa when they would get together. And that's these stories, right? These stories have largely been forgotten, unfortunately. So it's something that we're trying to bring to light.
I just wanted then to get more information then about some of the other women that have been included and their stories that we can expect in this calendar. In particular, you mentioned earlier Mata Kola, you also mentioned Mata Nanaki. So perhaps if we could just kind of start with those.
We'll start with Mata Nanaki. Mata Nanaki is the wife of Guru Hargobind. It's the mother of Guru Tegh Bahadur and the grandmother of Guru Gobind Singh. So actually Mata Nanaki was helping to raise Guru Gobind Singh when Guru Gobind Singh was a little toddler, and his father Guru Tegh Bahadur was out east. So Mata Nanaki played a massive role in the community, and this is another thing why we started this project. Was many people have not even heard of Mata Nanaki. You know, people have heard of Bibi Nanaki, Guru Nanak Dev Ji's sister, but not many people have heard of Mata Nanaki. Mata Nanaki was basically the pillar of the community from the time of Guru Arjan Dev Ji up to Guru Gobind Singh. So we think about Baba Buddha Ji as being there for six gurus, which is an insane length to be alive. You know, 100 plus years Baba Buddha Ji lived. But in the same way, we have an analog, we have a very similar comparison with Mata Nanaki, who, when she was a toddler, got to see Guru Arjan Dev Ji. She was married with Guru Arjan Dev Ji's son, Guru Hargobind Sahib, and then was basically the pillar of the community until Guru Gobind Singh's time. So when Guru Tegh Bahadur was shot, actually many people don't know this, and we depicted this story for the Mahalla 9 calendar, that Tir Mal had sent one of his sons, when Guru Tegh Bahadur became a guru, to basically loot the guru's house. People were coming there because they were bringing the guru offerings. So this masan named Siha, he came there, and they had guns back then, and this is something that you can check with Ramblings, our other talk that we did, right? Siha masan took a gun and shot at the guru, and it just grazed Guru Tegh Bahadur's forehead, luckily. And then Mata Nanaki came immediately and kind of put herself in front of Guru Tegh Bahadur and really chastised, really cussed out that masand. Then they basically all left. So she basically played a really protective role there as well, protecting her son, Guru Tegh Bahadur Sahib. So Mata Nanaki is just a massive figure during that time. And to really know the extent, you have to read the stories of Guru Hargobind Sahib, which we have covered in Suraj Prakash. Mata Nanaki, the amount of times Mata Nanaki gets mentioned is striking, especially when you consider how little we know of Mata Nanaki now. So that was something that we really wanted to kind of convey, is that Mata Nanaki played such an important role in the community for such a long time. So Mata Nanaki is a pillar. Mata Kola is also related to Guru Hargobind. When Guru Hargobind was stationed in Lahore, in the Mozang area, there was a Qazi there, a Muslim lawmaker, and he was quite vicious with his daughter, whose name was Kola. And that lawmaker also had stolen essentially a horse from the Guru. He had basically purchased it from the Mughals, who had stolen this horse that was en route from Kabul to Punjab. So Guru Hargobind is actually riding around in that area. Mata Kola sees Guru Hargobind, is totally infatuated with Guru Hargobind. And this is very much a love story, which is how Gurbani talks about our relationship with the divine. So this story is conveying this divine relationship with the devotee and the beloved. Mata Kaula then is luckily saved by Guru Hargobind. It's actually depicted. It's the story is told in Suraj Prakash, and you can check out the Suraj podcast for that, where Guru Hargobind basically goes on like a late night expedition around 12 o'clock at night, you know, jumps on his horse, pulls up to Mata Kaulanji's house. Kaulan jumps on the back of the horse and they ride out, and then they go to Amritsar from there. And this story is talked about in basically all the pre-colonial texts that we have from Sikhandi Pagtamala of Pai Mani Singh, from the Gurbalas associated with Mani Singh, Gurbalas Pachai Chemi, up to Suraj Prakash, etc. So Mata Kaulan's story also has been largely ignored, even though in Amritsar, beside Baba Atal Gurdwara, we even have called Sar Sarovar, which is really important out of the Sarovars in Amritsar for those who are doing the Tirath, the pilgrimage there to go to every single Sarovar, Ramsar Sarovar, Santokh Sar, etc., Bibek Sar. Kaul Sar Sarovar is one of the major five that people have to kind of bathe in to get that full experience of the Sarovars in Amritsar. So she and her memory is like Atal, it's eternal, but you know, it's largely been forgotten nowadays because of perhaps some misconceptions about the relationship that she had with Guru Hargobind. So she did not mother any children with Guru Hargobind, but she's largely thought as a mata, as one of the mothers of the community.
So I've got a question, and it is kind of slightly controversial. So if you aren't comfortable with the answer going public, then that's fine. I can edit it. But what I'm interested in then is, what are the relationships between the women and the gurus like? Because for argument's sake, quite often it's pointed out that Guru Hargobind Sahib Ji had more than one wife, Guru Gobind Singh Ji had more than one wife, etc. Like, how do pre-colonial texts deal with that, considering from a more modern post Singh Sabha movement, it's viewed almost as blasphemous or controversial or kind of somewhere on that scale? So
this is an important question. I think behooves us to think about this carefully, because the pre-colonial sources also talked about this very carefully. So we know, if we're going to take our history seriously, meaning if we're going to believe the pre-colonial sources, and they all state that Guru Hargobind had multiple wives, Guru Gobind Singh Ji had multiple wives, Guru Har Rai as well, etc. So how do we think about this? And if we look to how Kavi Santokh Singh wrote about this in Suraj Prakash, when Guru Hargobind is the first guru to have multiple wives. And on the occasion of his second marriage and his third marriage, Kavi Santokh Singh writes, the poet writes that essentially this is the tradition of Maharaja, of great kings. And in the same way that Guru Hargobind and the previous gurus had grasped tightly to Piri, a spiritual authority, they had also now grasped to Miri, a royalty or sovereignty authority as well. So in regard to that, they're also playing the games that are associated with that, which is building connections with other communities. So for example, one of the wives of Guru Hargobind, her name is Mata Morwahi, and that is actually not her real name. Morwahi is just the name of her clan of the Marwars, right? Her name is actually Mahadevi. So what can we derive from that? We can think of Guru Hargobind as marrying into other clans to build connections, as other Raji are doing as well, right? So it's very much in that light of kind of extending sovereignty, extending the influence of Sikhi across different lands as well. And because, you know, this becomes a tradition, that's how poets like Santokh Singh and other pre-colonial texts, Mani Singh, etc., are conveying those types of marriages, that, you know, this is representative of the Miri path, of the path of royalty, of sovereignty. So that's how they have understood that tradition.
No, I just wondered. I guess also it comes back to what you were saying about, like, narratives are suppressed. And I guess to some degree, just like we're trying to make sense of it, like the Singh Sabha, when they're kind of almost like reimagining these narratives, don't really have the words to be able to kind of understand it themselves and then explain it without being like, actually, this doesn't make sense, so let's just throw it out the window and just say it's nothing to do with us. Whereas I guess the work you're doing with the artwork that Simon and others are helping with, it's actually bringing those stories back out and going, here you are, like, have a look at it. what do the pre-colonial texts say about marriage rights? So there's this kind of common perception, or perhaps misperception, like correct me if I'm wrong, that the modern Anantgarh is something that evolved after the Gurus, and that during the times of the Gurus, it wasn't what we now have as the Anantgarh around the Guru Granth Sahib Ji, etc. From what you've read in the research you've done, what do the pre-colonial sources say about this?
The marriage rights associated with the Guru Hargobind and the different Matama. This is just correct that the way in which they got married during that time, as evidenced through the pre-colonial sources, depict a different way than how we do marriages today. And that shouldn't shock listeners. These traditions have evolved over time. Just like during that time, we had the Masand administration. There were Masands that were handling different congregations. That was a system that was set up by Guru Amar Das Ji, and it got taken down by Guru Gobind Singh. So things evolve, they change over time. And the version that we have now, the Anantgarh that we have today, is more of a recent tradition that the Panth has collectively agreed upon, and that's totally fine. There's only a few people that do it in a different way nowadays, Namdaris being one of them. But it is not uncommon for our grandparents. I remember my grandparents telling me that they knew many people that had what they call a bedi viha, meaning a wedding around fire, which is how the pre-colonial texts talk about the way in which Guru Hargobind had his marriages, and even up to Guru Gobind Singh's time. If you look at even the paintings associated with Guru Nanak Dev Ji's wedding, you'll see in Baba Atal, these are also the ways that Guru Nanak Dev Ji and the other gurus had their wedding rites. But what's interesting is in the pre-colonial texts, when they're talking about these traditions, it always says very, and this is kind of gives us clues as to how people at that time thought about these wedding rites. It says, Kul ki rit, that these are the traditions of their lineage. So in a sense that, yeah, they were just performing whatever rites that their family would have performed. This is not to say that this is a Gursikh way to do it. It's just to say that they were doing it according to that family. Later on, more traditions evolved where Gursikhs are saying, okay, the wedding should be done in this prescribed manner, which was different from before. So the fact that the old stories mention wedding rites being different, it shouldn't make us feel uncomfortable. It shouldn't shock us. Traditions evolve over time, and that's not abnormal.
I think one of the reasons why some people watching this may be shocked is because you never ever hear of this of these pre-colonial texts mentioning the manner within which these marriage rites were carried out. And equally, one thing that I've noticed with the work that you guys are doing and the research you're putting together with the artwork Simran and others are creating is there's this want for historical accuracy. So I think people watching this, and especially if they're still watching it at this point, obviously are interested in similar things that we are, which is wanting to make sure that we kind of are as accurate to the facts, however you wish to define that, as possible. So what other things are there kind of in the project that point to this? So you earlier mentioned Mata Sahib Devi is referred to as Mata Sahib Kaur within the modern lens. Why has that happened? And equally, are there any other examples within the project that you could point to?
Well, it's interesting. One way that we're trying to be authentic to the historical sources is just depicting, you know, what the characters are wearing. So for example, Bibi Pani, there's this whole story related to her nose ring. And this is an interesting point to think about, because the way in which we imagine the history of old, whether it be the Matama and the women of the Panth, or it be even the Gurus, for example, when people look at some of the pre-colonial paintings of the Gurus, it's not odd to find them wearing earrings. Now we say, okay, is this Gurmat? Is this, the Gurus thinking to wear jewelry? And it's really interesting that throughout the pre-colonial text, you'll find the Gurus depicted in this way, the Gurus distributing jewelry as gifts to his Sangat. So even when, for example, 1699, Guru Gobind Singh is creating, fashioning, establishing the Khalsa, Guru Gobind Singh gives the Khalsa, the Panch Pyare, his roop. He gives him his form, the clothing, the weaponry, and the jewelry. Because Guru Gobind Singh is a Maharaja, right? He's a Maharaja, so he adorns jewelry, just like Maharaja did. And in the same way, he's making his Sikhs royal in that sense as well. He's making them sovereign. He's making them powerful and prestigious. So in the same way, the Guru is adorning and him with his own hands, it mentions that Guru Gobind Singh is fashioning jewelry onto his Panch Pyare. It's a beautiful story there told in Suraj Prakash. And I think in that way, it kind of shows a very interesting concept that we have largely ignored in when we look at these historical texts. And if we can then associate imagery with the stories of the Guru and with the stories of the Sikhs, I think that helps us remember a lot of these stories as well. For example, we were talking about marriage rites, and one of the stories of Guru Tegh Bahadur's wedding is that they were distributing these large jalebis. And that's so fascinating because I had a cousin who went to a wedding recently, and she was telling me that, they were giving out jalebis at this wedding. And I remembered Guru Tegh Bahadur's wedding as told on the podcast. And I'm like, that's brilliant. That's exactly how these stories are constructed, to kind of overlay ideas which will be encountered in the real world, right? You're going to see these type of foods mentioned. You're going to see this type of clothing or jewelry, or, you know, certain types of horses or weaponry and et cetera. And that's going to automatically build this matrix of memory back to the Guru, right? So everything becomes, the Guru becomes that locus. And if we start cutting off these, connections between the material, between the world in front of us, then the Guru just becomes whited out. The Guru becomes without any color, without any flavor, without any association. And that's why I think that in the poetry of the pre-colonial texts, where it's describing the Guru, you have such emotion depicted, you know? And this is even in the writings of Gurbani, where it's describing the divine, you know? Santana dokapai te dukhi, that the divine is sad when his sons, when the divine's sons, saints, are pained, right? And that gets manifested in the tales of the Sikh Gurus of old. So for example, we talked about Mata Kolna. When Mata Kolna ji passes away, tears flow from Guru Hargobind's eyes. This is how it's described by Pai Mani Singh's Guru Das Pashai Chami. And that's powerful when you think about this connection between the divine and his Bhagat, his devotee, right? Because it shows that there's a reciprocal interaction and a care and a love on both sides, not just that we are just, you know, praying to this divine and this we're not getting anything back, but it's a reciprocal engagement. It's a connection with something that also loves you. And, you know, these stories manifest in that way. People can look at that story and say, why did Guru Hargobind care about some woman? And that's a very kind of crude way of thinking about the itihas, the history. It's cutting away the philosophical components, but also it's cutting away the emotional components that the poet is trying to convey through these stories.
Without starting a whole other podcast, I think one thing that is quite apparent, and like feel free to like add your own thoughts to this, which is like the idea of divinity and how that is then portrayed through art. So I think a lot of what you're discussing in relation to the pre-colonial text seems to be that there is an understanding of the divinity or the divine in a very different perspective or worldview. And then post kind of colonialism, Singh Sabha movement, etc., we've moved to a very Judeo-Christian Protestant understanding of what the divine is. How, I guess, as an artist, first Simran, if I could ask you, like, how do you try to, like, how do you engage with the text? So when you get the story, like, how do you make sure that you're bringing it to life as accurately as possible? Like, how do you approach that as an artist, taking the text and the work that the research that Jawal has done, and then turning that into something that is visual for us all to see?
I think what's like the most important thing is that, like, you're not creating a piece based on a story that's kind of taking place now. So it's really important to keep in mind kind of historical references. So you do the research of kind of looking through collections of paintings. So for this project, I put together a file, a Google file, for all the artists and sent that over with reference images that were from the the timeline of all of the stories, and then you take those along and I guess try and be as truthful as you can to the story, because with all the information given, there was an outline of a story you could use, or like a composition you could use for the paintings, but it's kind of like let the artist connect with the story first before you kind of come in and you say anything. So it was like for my story especially, I was given the story and then I spoke to the other researcher first, and he kind of explained it a little bit more to me. And then I guess what's really important about this calendar as well is being able to put yourself in the footsteps of the women and be able to kind of experience what the story is trying to tell you as well. So with this, I've used a lot of gold and a lot of kind of illumination to depict that feeling of liberation and being completely detached from the bondage of this life. So being able to express that via material all comes from being able to connect to the story. And I guess it's being able to sit and properly read and put yourself in that space to understand what was going on in the kind of the image that you've been given.
No, definitely. Javala, I just wanted then to find out, are there any other instances, like you spoke about Mata Sahib Devi being called Mata Sahib Kaur and kind of the reason behind the suppression of particular narratives, and we've touched upon how some of that is perhaps connected to the philosophy or the ideology of how we perceive the divine. Like, are there any other examples?
Well, yeah, another kind of a big thing that we wanted to draw out, and which will likely be the cover of the calendar, is this idea about the soul bride, meaning in Gurbani, they use this Rupak Alankar, this kind of poetic device, describing all of us, everybody in the world, as women who are then going to be united with their divine husband. And that connection, so they're using a metaphor here, that the husband, when unites with the bride on their bed on their wedding night, you know, that anand, that bliss that they have there, is this connection that we have as souls or atma, that when it's united with Paramatma, there's a connection there, that kind of a mystical experience, that anand that one gets feeling connected with everything, the entire world. That is kind of brought in by this metaphor about, okay, we are all soul brides and we are adorning ourselves with a shangad, with jewelry, embellishment, etc. And in Gurbani, that's described as shubh gona, like these good qualities, like sata, santoka, daya, taram, etc. All of these, right? Truth, compassion, righteousness, nimrta, all of these, or you can say humility, all of these qualities are essentially our jewelry that we are adorning, that we hope to kind of entice the divine such that we are united, you know. And also related to bhakti, kind of this devotion, kind of asking for this union with the divine. So that's going to be likely the cover of the calendar, is depicting in a visual representation of the soul bride, who then is eventually united with the divine. So that is an idea that largely through, we can say, a Protestant understanding of Sikhi, you know, through the colonial period, we largely became uncomfortable with this metaphor on account of, you know, it can be graphic in a certain sense, right? There's lines in Gurbani that says, like, Gurmukha Ravahe Sohagani So Prava Seja Patar, that the Gurmukh, who is the Sohagani, who's the, you can say, you know, the happy soul bride, is ravished, like this kind of this anand that she gets in this union. And that anand is the same, that bliss is the same type of bliss that we get when we feel connected with the entirety of the samsara, of the world, right? Through that mystical experience, through that union with Paramatma, the divine. So those metaphors, largely because, you know, in some sense they could be thought of as explicit, the union between husband and wife, have largely been ignored. But it is actually that metaphor, I would think, is if not the most common metaphor used in Gurbani, but certainly amongst the most common metaphors used in Gurbani. You know, you have other metaphors that say, for example, the divine Paramatma is my mother, divine Paramatma is my father, right? And we are the children. That gets used far less than this analogy of the woman and her husband, kind of because it's related to it brings in this idea about unity, and it brings in this idea about bliss. So that's actually what we're trying to convey as well with the cover image that we are
going to be having on the calendar yet.
No, definitely. I guess also in some ways the parent-child metaphor actually puts the divine on a higher pedestal, whereas the unity metaphor actually makes the divine and yourself on the same level, which again harks back to the idea that the idea of the divinity or the philosophy within kind of Sikh ideology definitely evolved through or changed. I don't know evolved, because that has kind of positive connotations, but it certainly changed with the colonial period to something that, like as you said, kind of like some of the most common metaphors are kind of suppressed because of certain uncomfortabilities with that. So when you're talking about this metaphor of the soul bride and essentially this male-female metaphor, which I guess, and again correct me if I'm wrong, is also kind of that Shiv Shakti metaphor, that yin and yang, that kind of like the duality of divinity kind of combining to creating this one or non-duality essentially. How is that evolving or changing also then influenced our perception of things, not just like Sikh history, but also our own Gurbani? So Dasam Granth is usually seen in quite a controversial lens, mainly because of some of the charitras which discuss or talk about women. Again, before we get into what they talk about, I just want to kind of understand, like, what do you think perhaps leads to our modern day misunderstanding of things like Dasam Granth or the charitras, or even some of the history that you've already discussed?
That's a great question, because you know, in relation to that soul bride, that is just one metaphor. That's one, just a way to understand the divine and our role in that as well. So when we look, and that's just one of many ways that the gurus have written about this in Guru Granth Sahib, all the Guru Granth Sahib. Guru Gobind Singh uses a very interesting way of taking that, this idea about the feminine, and then constituting that, utilizing that in a way that's kind of bringing in martial aspects as well. So, you know, Dasam Granth has a lot of sections about Chandi, Durga, you know, Pavani, the goddess. How are we to understand those then, right? When we think about, oh, is this just a goddess that's underneath something else that's above it, like Akal Purkh? Because we have Akal Purkh at the beginning of Japji Sahib, Mool Mantra. And Purkh there is a masculine noun, right? So we can, you know, this is why that in a lot of the Christianized translations of Guru Granth Sahib, you'll have it there that he is the divine being or the creator, etc., right? You have the he there because it's a masculine noun. Well, in Guru Gobind Singh's writings, he's writing about the divine as the feminine, you know, Sri Pagavati Ji Sahai. You know, he's writing as, and you can say that, okay, he's talking about the sword, but is it the sword there? Like, that's a feminine word, right? And throughout Guru Gobind Singh's writings, he has this, even in compositions like Jap Sahib, which are largely praise of the divine through negation. You know, the Paramatma is not this, he's not that, you know, just like the Vedas, neti, neti, na iti, na iti. So you have, even in Jap Sahib, you have namo sasrapane, namo astarmane, namo paramagyata, namo lokmata, that the divine is that one who's holding shastra. The divine is that one who utilizes astar, these kind of projectile weapons. Namo paramagyata, namo the highest wisdom, which you can think about Paramatma in the divinity form of Saraswati, the one who conveys wisdom and beauty and excellence. Namo Lokmata, you know, salutation to that mother of the world. And this is, we see in Chopai Sahib as well, Lokmata, Jagmata is used as well, this term that the divine is the mother of the entire world. So then we can say that Guru Gobind Singh is talking about that same divine, Akal Purkh, as described in Mool Mantra, but in a feminine way of describing the divine. And this is where we should not be confused that, oh, he's talking about some goddess that's below the divine. Because even in, you have a composition called Akal Usut, you know, the praise of the divine, the timeless, the deathless. And even at the start of this, it says, Charana Saran Je Basta Pavani, that Pavani, a goddess, is at the Charan, at the kind of the refuge, at the lotus-like feet of the divine. But when it's talking about the divine later on in that composition, it is describing Durga, Pavani, Chandi as the actual divine as well. So there's this play between understanding the divine as one without quality, and you're doing that because at least in Sikh, you know, philosophy, the divine transcends any notion of any concept at all. You can never box in the divine. Yet at the same time, that doesn't allow you to talk about anything material. So there's a limitation in that. So when the guru is talking about material aspects of the divine, which we call sarguna, he's invoking certain characteristics and ideas that are pertinent to the guru, which are that the divine is the grantor of knowledge. So he's bringing in that idea of Saraswati, Bhavani, Durga as well. And that the divine is the one who bashes all the enemies as well, which is in Indic thought. You know, nobody is as powerful as Durga in the battlefield, right? So to kind of draw those elements in, they're using the mythos, they're using the mythology associated with Durga to kind of convey this martial spirit. And the guru does that with other things as well. When he's talking about in Krishna avatar, when he's talking about Krishna fighting in battle, you know, when you compare Guru Gobind Singh's versions, and I have an article I'm currently writing up for a journal about this, but when you compare Guru Gobind Singh's versions of Krishna avatar, which is the 10th canto, Dasam Skand of a text called a Bhagavad Purana, when you compare that with other Braj retellings of that section, his is just incredibly viciously violent when compared to the other ones. And it's like, why is it different? What is the context of Guru Gobind Singh's poetry? Who's listening to it? And what is he trying to convey in that writing, right? He's trying to inspire martial spirit, right? At the end of it says, Taram Yodake Chai, for the kind of to evoke this kind of enthusiasm for Taram Yod, right? He explicitly is writing his purpose for this. So again, the way in which we talk about the divine relates to our interaction and our the way we need to conceptualize the divine. So in Adh Guru Granth Sahib, when they're talking about having this unity with the entire world, the way to do that is in one metaphor, talking about the soul bride and the soul husband. You can think about there's a certain connection that needs to be formed between the two on this bed of the world by adorning good qualities, by having devotion and nimrata to that divine, right? And in Guru Gobind Singh's Bani, when he's trying to inspire martial spirit, he's talking about the divine integrated with the mythology of Durga as this kind of martial divine who is you know, the queen of the world, who's destroying everything with her kurban, and she's represented by the kurban, the sword as well, right? So that gets put into Sripa Gautiji's high in the invocations of Guru Gobind Singh. So it really matters in relation to how we think about the divine, and the ways we can think about the divine change according to the context, but they draw to a certain meaning.
No, definitely. One question that I have then, and like, feel free, Javala, to correct me if you think I'm wrong on this, but would it be fair to say that, especially when you're referring to Carlos, the Jopi Sahib, Jap Sahib, a lot of the compositions that Guru Gobind Singh has written, and just from what you were saying, that there is this understanding of the divine being non-dual, so this Akal Purakh, which is beyond time, beyond death, beyond everything, so therefore it doesn't fall into this Kalyug or Maya of duality, and then actually the manifestations or the way within which attributes of the non-dual are described or conveyed are through things that are familiar. So as you said, the destructive force is conveyed through Durga.
Absolutely. And you find this, so Akalus is a good example, because Dhirga Tirpa Angichanda is a section at the end of Akalus, maybe three quarters of the way in, where it goes really heavy into the mythos of Mahakasar Maradini, right? This, you know, the one who destroys Mahakasar, who is Durga, right? Who is Chandi. So you're exactly right that there's, it's from a starting point of, you know, the divine is something that transcends all qualities. But when you're trying to connect with something that is beyond quality, how do you do that? You have to do that through qualities, through sargun, right? So even when we think about, you know, bhakti, a kind of devotion, to have devotion, one needs to have something to be devoted to, right? So in that sense, you can say that, oh, well, you know, this is a, you have a dualistic way of thinking about this, then you're separate from the divine. But this is kind of a starting point where, in first of all, in recognizing what is the divine, you cultivate a certain attitude and characteristics like Shobgorn, like the good qualities, like I was talking about this Shangar that the woman adorns, right, to attract the husband, you know, qualities of Nimrata and et cetera, et cetera. And then through that process of bhakti, of devotion, then one gets the wisdom of what the divine actually is through that integration, through that connection, right, that happens on that bed. So there's this play that happens between Sargun and Nirgun, between the divine with quality and without quality. And you'll see different stories get brought up in even Adh Guru Granth Sahib. Actually, Simran Kaur's beautiful painting of Vishnu coming down and saving the elephant. Am I correct on that, Simran?
Yeah. Saving Gajendra, yeah.
That's a beautiful reference that if you didn't know the mythology regarding that reference, right, you wouldn't understand what Guru Tegh Bahadur is writing when he says, Gaja jiyo ho sahai, right? Just like you save the elephant, Paramatma, please come and save me as well. So you're drawing on notions and mythology that has been used before, but I do want to say there is a repurposing of this mythology. So just by drawing on, let's say, the stories of Durga or the stories of Vishnu saving the elephant or the stories of Ramchandra, the stories of Hanuman, etc., which find reference in Guru Granth Sahib and Dasam Granth, one does not automatically then, that's not a substantiation, that's not an agreement on everything they have in their mythology. And how we can tell this is, and this is not just a thought about this, you can tell this by the ways in which the repurposing is happening. So actually, if you went to, let's say, pundits who have studied the Sanskrit or like the original texts of these mythologies, they'll largely disagree with how it's being presented in Guru Granth Sahib and Dasam Granth, right? And what does that tell you? That there's a repurposing happening. There's even a modernization happening. Like, you know, the stories of Durga are thousands of years old. In Guru Gobind Singh's version, they have guns in these stories. And people also don't even know that the gurus had guns, which is, you know, people should know that. Even Guru Hargobind had 60 riflemen always around him. That Guru Gobind Singh is writing these stories about Chandi, who has in her army warriors who are like shooting guns at the Rakshas, at the demons. And this is the same thing in other texts that Guru Gobind Singh writes. So there's a repurposing of the mythology to fit the philosophy of Gurmat. And one should not be uncomfortable with engaging with that mythology when understanding the Gurbani.
One question that I had for Simran is, what do you think has been the greatest difficulty that you find when you're, as an artist, creating these pieces of work?
I think the biggest thing is kind of muting a lot of history because it's just not agreed upon now. Like that when I had painted that the Gajendra Moksha, I had a lot of backlash from it, kind of going, oh, you know, this is not within Sikhi, you're doing everything wrong, you know, you're following kind of Hindu traditions rather than following stories of the gurus and stuff. And then it's just a lack of kind of courage in the house. People don't want to listen, they don't want to have a look, they don't want to accept the fact that we're very connected to these stories, and the gurus brought these stories into the world for a reason, and they make sense, and they teach you how to kind of live now and kind of lead your life. So I think the biggest thing that I found is having to mute a lot of things, like even within these pieces of work, not being able to fully depict how a woman would have dressed then, you know, fully out there with everything going on. But you wouldn't be able to do that because, again, Gurdwari would not sell the painters, sell the calendars, would not have them up. People would not want to have them in their houses because it's just this muting of history and things that are important that are not agreed upon post-colonialism.
If I could add to that, sorry.
Yeah, please, yeah, go ahead.
It's really interesting when you look at some of the paintings in the 19th century. For example, Bishan Singh has this beautiful painting of women cooking in a tandoor, actually. So Bishan Singh is a very famous painter of the 19th century, of the 1800s. And he paints the Darbar Sahib and he paints other scenes from Punjab. And if you look at the way the women are dressed there, and this is understandable, fashion changes over time. And oftentimes, like the younger generation, will be like, oh, the older generation dressed stupid, or the older generation will be like the younger generation dressed stupid. And these are the challenges, right, that Simran's talking about, because if you look in the way the women are dressed in that 19th century painting, they have bare bellies, some of the clothing might seem revealing, they're breastfeeding in public. A lot of these components where if this was happening
nowadays in Punjab, this would make people really uncomfortable, right? So we have to know that, especially when depicting stories of old, that they perhaps dress differently. Social etiquette around dress was probably different. And this is like we were talking about before, about jewelry, even components like that become hard to convey and show in these paintings.
So are there certain things as an artist then that you just, or kind of as a collective, you've kind of just decided not to depict or not to include? Or like, are there some kind of, not necessarily steps backwards, but are there kind of like, just because, as you mentioned, there's certain modern responses to certain things that you guys have decided not to depict certain things in certain ways?
I think more or less from all the stories, they're all, there's not too much that you'd kind of go, no, wait a second, you shouldn't be showing that. Yeah, there's not too much, but I think it's kind of clothing wise and jewelry wise and things like that. So the references are pretty, most of them are from the Thor collection. Yeah, so the references chosen, we've kind of, not really modest, but kind of gone for the more, like the more kind of Punjabi attire of like gurdwara tops and like chunnis over. So it's not too much that like people in gurdwara will feel so uncomfortable that they'll completely reject the calendar, because the work is important and it's important to go like get out there. So if we have to mute a tiny bit, it's fine, but as long as the whole story isn't changing, that's what matters. So if we can tweak it slightly, it's great. Like most of the paintings are very, very accurate to the time and the references. But again, it's all about getting it out there. So if we can do that, that's what matters.
No, definitely. So also, Simran, if you could just tell us which other artists are involved?
We've got a bunch of artists. I don't know them all off by heart, but we have Jitinder's on board. We have Sunroop on board. We have Manny, who was on the last calendar as well. He's on board. He also on board. We've got a couple of artists out in the community as well, digital artists. So we've kind of commissioned, I think two Muslim artists as well have come on board. We have a lot of digital work this time, which is really good because that opens up that platform too. It's nice to see the skills that people have on that, in that form of work as well. What her name's Hasidat Kaur. She's known as Sundar Siyahi on Instagram. She's on board as well. So these are just the ones that I know, like I can think of at the top of my
mind.
We've got a good bunch. It's a very nice bunch.
No, brilliant. Just out of curiosity, do you actually think we can undo the damage Singh Sabha has done completely, or are we actually evolving into essentially what is like a third phase, where it's like neo pre-colonial in a sense, like we're trying to reimagine what the pre-colonial was like in the new age, if you get what I mean?
This is how I think it evolved, man. I think it went from like Ranjit Singh's time, which went hella Sanatan, you know, if you could use that term, where there was such a buy-in with the Indic mythology, to the extent that they ignored the Islamic mythology that's utilized in Gurbani as well. And you can tell this when you look at the DK, the commentaries of Guru Granth Sahib, like that line, Tol Taram Deya Kaput, that Tol there is this bull from Islamic mythology. I've not seen one Tika that's actually explained that that's from Islamic mythology. Why? Because they were so invested in the Sanskritic kind of mythology, which is fine, but they went heavy into that, right? They went so far into that to an extent that they started being steeped in that, and then the influence of that resulted in them being like, you know what, Shurdars shouldn't be doing Ishnan and Darbar Sahib. And they brought in elements that even us, as we look into the old stuff, we like, the old stuff is dope, but like none of us would agree that you would prevent like a low caste from doing Ishnan at the Darbar Sahib, right? So that resulted in then the Singh Sabha going the other way. Like it polarized, right? It went the other way. And even people like Veer Singh, who I should have mentioned this, but even he says Sahib Devan. He doesn't say Sahib Gaur, right? So he's steeped in the old text as well. It's not even people like Veer Singh who are like the really hardcore Singh Sabha. The really hardcore Singh Sabha are like these other guys who took it to the other extreme, right? Tejas Singh Pasoria and these type of people. And so they actually had some good ideas, right? Like, of course we don't believe in Jathpat, number one. Like, that's totally nonsense. And like, these ideas about Devi and stuff, they had a point that Devi relates to Akal Purakh, but they were just stuck in this masculine way of understanding the divine, because the Christian people understood their divine in a masculine, right? So they were like, And in their time, the feminine was so low that they were not going to be like Jagamata. They were not going to be like Paramatma is the mother of the world, because for them, they had this understanding of women that was so like, it's beneath us, they basically thought, right? Engaging in the Sanatan stuff is definitely helpful because it helps you get the essence of what Gurbani was talking about. But it doesn't mean we are like substantiating. We don't agree with everything that they're doing, right?
And it's not the whole picture either.
No. So I think at some point now we're going to come back into the middle, and I hope we don't go again, we don't swing back in that, but we're getting somewhere in the middle. So I think it's possible, but yeah, I'm optimistic anyways. I'm curious to see how we will integrate our understanding as we go back to the pre-colonial into the modern time. Because there's one thing to just go hardcore nostalgic into the past, and you know, you're just secluded and you're living in a different world. Whereas like Sikhi has always shown us that it's about the integration, right? If you don't integrate into the modern world, and this is like, I'm not like one of those Dilsaf type of people, but like, you know what I mean? Like you have to be able to take the Siddhant, the essence of it, and integrate with where you are, right? That's why Gris Jivan, I think, is so important. It throws you in the deep end. It's like, all right, you think all of this, go try to do that now with a family.
Just a quick question on that. Obviously, you've seen the thread about the artwork, like the Sikh artwork that's literally like a duplicate of like some European or some American or some, and it had a lot of like backlash of all sorts of people, very angry that I'd even posted these comparisons, right?
Yeah.
Oh, got it. Oh, massively. Oh, so there was, I think the one that pissed a lot of people off was Guru Nanak Devji's photo next to that, like, I forgot his name, but he's like a goat slash devil, whatever. And they're doing the exact same hand pose. And people are like, oh,
yeah.
And people are like, how dare you? And like, you're like, you had no, don't know any better and all the rest of it, whatever. One thing that wasn't picked up on, and I found it quite interesting, was no one even questioned the depictions of the gurus. So everyone was happy with the way the gurus were depicted, and actually a lot of the backlash was the fact that I'd even made these comparisons. Now, why do you think certain depictions of the gurus or certain depictions of Sikh history are more accepted than others?
Well, nothing is created in a vacuum, right? So you're always attaching and you're always integrating what you're doing with the culture around you. So we've now entered, you know, in this post-colonial era. And what are the kind of the mythos, the mythology, the narratives that we connect with? Somebody like Napoleon and that style of artwork is appealing. So yeah, we're going to plaster, you know, a depiction of Guru Gobind Singh in the form of that. And like Simran was talking about, this is not uncommon, right? This is not uncommon at all. And, you know, if you look at the pre-colonial depictions of the gurus, they're largely painted in this Mughal-esque fashion, right? And you're basically using the visual repertoire, the kind of the mythology, the kind of the styles of the time, and you're creating your own version of that, right? And this is not different at all from the poetic compositions that we see within Guru Granth Sahib, Dasam Granth, the Itihasik Granth, the historical texts as well. You're using genres that are kind of prevalent and that you're connected to through cultural interaction, and that have prestige and that have importance within the larger public. And then you're repurposing that to put your own flavor on top of it. And this is what we see nowadays with these animations of the gurus and the sahibzade in the CGI, right? In this animation style. What needs to be done though, is that when you see these animations and stuff, they just basically white out the guru. They white out any interaction that the guru has with his Sikhs, what they say even. So those type of liberties were taken in historical texts. For example, Santokh Singh, when he's writing about the guru has dialogue in these texts, and you can say, oh, it's never, the guru never wrote those words, so how do we know the guru said that, you know? And I think that's kind of an immature kind of way to engage with this. Like, we're always repurposing, we're always refashioning the myths and the stories of old to engage the people of the present culture. And this is it's strange that people got upset about that. It's not the fact that Guru Gobind Singh is being depicted as Napoleon, which makes that a terrible piece of art, is the actual, the artwork itself. Like if it was a beautiful version of that, perhaps that would have been amazing, you know? And in commissioning other artists like Simran and the other artists for this Mahalla 9 project, what we hope to do is kind of build this visual culture, build this expertise in painting. Like Simran mentioned before, that we have not only Bahari or Mughal style artists, like how Simran beautifully does her artwork, but we have other digital artists as well. And we want to bring in a range of different styles of art so we can depict these stories and the gurus and the matama in various ways. And hopefully also then in animation and in video, etc.
I think for me, what was most perturbing about some of the comparisons that I'd posted about was the fact that, and you guys have touched upon it brilliantly, was that its basis was not in our history. So the Napoleon one itself, like, so for me, I understand, like, essentially what we're doing is we're in the West, so we're connecting to the narratives and the myths and the kind of the narratives that are just kind of out there in the public. So Napoleon is seen in the popular narrative as this great general who almost conquered all of Europe and all the rest of it. And equally, he's around at the same time Mahalanobis Singh is around, or just prior. But to me, what was most disturbing was the fact that that has no connection or basis to do with Guru Gobind Singh Ji or with Sikh history. So for me, it's like, actually, we have such a rich history and a rich, not just in terms of textual sources, but also kind of visually, that that same artist, and I don't know any of them, and I don't have any personal gripe against this, and I get that it's something that occurs through art and even just through any creative medium, but it's just the fact that why not take that extra 5 or 10 minutes and check our own sources, our own material, and then come back. Again, the Baba Deep Singh Ji one, which is essentially a ripoff of that scene from 300. Like, I get it. I've watched 300. I love 300. Think it's a great movie. I think it has a lot of similarities to do with how we evoke images and understandings of the Akalis of old. But I think it's quite crass and slightly insulting to essentially put a turban on whoever that actor was who played the main guy in 300. I forgot his name now or whatever. But like, that's the uncomfortability. And that's why I find this project really exciting, because there's a care and attention to the source. There's a care and attention to how it's depicted. There's a want for historical accuracy. There's a want to put it within the kind of the philosophical framework that is most accurate. But yeah, I just find it nuts that certain depictions of the gurus are accepted or not accepted, but then there are certain things that are just like beyond the pale and you're not allowed to even, like, not even allowed to approach it. But I think, again, it comes back to what we were saying earlier about the perception of the divine or our understanding of the divine.
So the perception, right? Because if you look in the 20th century Solba Singh's paintings, that speaks to how Solba Singh and perhaps the broader culture was thinking about and conceptualizing Guru Nanak, Guru Tegh Bahadur. Look at his Guru Tegh Bahadur, right? When you look at old paintings of Guru Tegh Bahadur, he's always strapped with weapons. He's a warrior. You go hunting, the son of Cheme Pacha, Guru Hargobind. Guru Tegh Bahadur was always depicted as a warrior in these old paintings, right? But Solba Singh is depicting him in a different light, you know? And that cello, that represents the kind of the way he's thinking about it and perhaps the way the broader culture is thinking about it. But yeah, I'm excited about this project as well, because we're trying to dig deep into the old sources, trying to convey what the old sources are saying and how they thought about the guru. Because one thing is that when you read some of the old sources, you're actually having a conversation. Like when you read Suraj Prakash, you're having a conversation with Santokh Singh. He's talking to you. You may not be able to talk back to him, but he's talking to you about the description of Guru Gobind, saying Guru, you know, Tegh Bahadur, Guru Hargobind, etc. And then to take those words, right, and convey them, I think, it's just amazing what Simran Kaur and some of the artists are doing with that. I'm really excited about this project.
One last question for both of you. I'll start with you, Simran. And it's actually just come to me now that we spoke about Solba Singh. So if anyone listening isn't aware of Solba Singh, I'd be slightly surprised, but he is essentially, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, probably one of the most popular Sikh artists of the 20th century, pretty much every household within the 80s, 90s would have had a Solbusing painting somewhere. And I'm sure most people listening also have some family member or relative who met Solbusing or something. Like, there's always some like little story. And he had such a lasting impact that even now, a lot of people envision the gurus through the depictions that Solbusing made. So Simran, what do you think the community will perceive the gurus and other kind of historical figures in 10 or 15 years time, considering there are artists like yourself and loads of others involved in projects like this and in other works that you guys produce that are reproducing different images of the guru or scenes of Sikh history? Like, how do you think they're going to have an impact on the community in the long run? Just like, I guess, Solbusing had an impact, how do you think you guys will influence the community in generations to come?
I think what's really clever about this project is that it's a calendar project, so it's something that does belong in your house. It's not just a painting that you shelve away or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just put it in a shelf and then it's gone. It's not something like that. And so you are looking at it every day. Your kids are looking at it every day. Your family are looking at it every day. And then you're passing down their stories, and people ask questions. People want to know more. It invokes conversation. You then keep the images. You then, you know, like, you can frame them if you want. You can do whatever you want with them. And that then passes down, this imagery passes down, and then more artists start creating work that's similar, and it's this kind of domino effect. And it all starts from just, you know, being able to put your feet out there and just start the conversation. And that's why, like, these projects are really, really important, and it's being able to start the conversation that changes the narrative and then builds the next stage of, I guess, what we want the faith to be, like, to what the next part of Sikhi is going to be and the next form of work that's going to come through. So I think these kind of projects have the power to do that, and we hope so. Hopefully the calendar does that 100%.
No, definitely. Javala, equally, I just wanted to get your opinion of, like, similarly to, like, how Solbusing has had a lasting impact on the community, how do you think projects like this and other work that the artists such as Simran and others that you guys have mentioned will have on the community in 10, 15, 20 years time, or even longer, considering how much of an impact Solbusing has had?
I think it's a question about representation. I think that's why it's awesome to have this calendar. It's just depicting Sikh women. I think when people look at these images, they'll start to question more. Okay, Simran Kaur is doing one about Bibi Bani. Who is she? Do people know that the whole land around Amritsar was put under her name? So when Akbar donates all of this land, Guru Amar Das Ji signs it under Bibi Bani Ji's name. That all of that land, she was the owner of that land. Do even people know that women could even own land at that time? I think these are the discussions that will come out from the physical kind of representation for people having these calendars in their home. Along with the visual representation, there's going to be snippets of information like that beside the calendar, referenced with historical texts. These are not, we're just not making these stories up out of thin air, which has happened in more recent time about some of Sikh history. So definitely representation. It shows people that, you know, Bibi Bani, these other women were so important to the community, so integral, so that younger Sikh women can also see that they also have a place within the community as well, which, it has been lacking, certainly. And this is one way to address it. Another way is that, you know, we're actually getting, like Simran Kaur has, and the other artists as well, have put a lot of time into crafting their art. So this was not just a matter of bring whoever in to draw whatever. This was a matter of bringing in artists who are exceptional at their craft, have put time into it, and they're going to be depicting amazing pieces of art. So that's one. That's the second thing. And the third thing, I mean, even now, and you yourself have probably noticed this, is that when people have shed light on, let's say, the Pai Rupa collection or the collection associated with the Sodis of Kartarpur, etc., these paintings of the gurus that they claim and likely are, you know, authentic paintings of Guru Hargobind, Guru Gobind Singh, etc., you're seeing modern artists now doing or creating artwork in that same style, to the extent that you have all these different versions now of I've seen, which is so beautiful for me to see, like different versions of Guru Hargobind being painted that are very similar to those authentic paintings of the Guru that even Bidhichand's descendants have in the village of Sur Singh. So it's a way of looking back to see what was there in the past, but it's not only that, it's also a way of looking forward and creating something new and innovative and beautiful. That's the thing as well, is that not just creating it for the sake of creating it, there's no participation awards here in medals. It's about creating something beautiful. And if that's you know, tied in with historical accuracy and in the mythos that Gurbani and historical texts have been engaged with for centuries, then all the better and all the more powerful. So yeah, I'm really excited about this project.
No, definitely. Okay, one last question, and you guys can't think about the answer too long. I just want a quick response. Is so first, Simon, if I can start with you, which has been your favorite story so far in all of the ones that that you guys have covered in the project?
Because I sat with the other researcher, and I was the one who kind of gave everyone. We sat and we assigned all the roles to everyone, and not the only one, but the one that stood out to me the most was Bibi Bani Ji. And just because I'd never thought that this was their relationship with Guru Amar Das Ji. Like I couldn't fathom that was that kind of relationship. And just being able to remind someone that, you know, you're not just bound by your human life. There's more, there's an extent, there's something that extends from there. And I think that's the one story that I connected to the most.
No, thank you. And equally, Jafala, what has been the most interesting or your favorite story out of all of the ones that have been covered or are being covered in the calendar?
I think Mata Golnaji has been kind of my favorite so far, just because, you know, I've really been steeped in the stories of Guru Hargobind for a couple of years now. And just the way in which that story gets told across different texts is super interesting as well. Very much like in the way that Gurblas represents a story, Gurblas Pachat Chemi. It's this really story of love, and actually the backstory, kind of the previous life description that's given in the text, is very much akin to how Guru Gobind Singh describes the story of Hir Ranja. So if you look in the Charitrabakhyan, Guru Gobind Singh's version of Hir Ranja, beautiful. It's actually 60, 70 years prior to the most famous Vadishah version. But in this version, Hir actually gets cursed in the heavens because of Kapil Muni. Kapil Muni is this very famous Rishi Muni, this sage from Indic mythology. And it's a really funny story, because Guru Gobind Singh is actually taking a little bit of a jab towards these Bahangams, towards these celibates. Kapil Muni just sees Manika, I think her name is, this Apasharan, this kind of this heavenly damsel. And Kapil Muni, unfortunately, even though he's a celibate and he's a great sage and seer and all this, can't control himself. And Guru Gobind Singh describes Kapil Muni's seed falls on the floor. Basically, he spoils himself. He for lack of a better term, and he gets angry because, you know, a celibate is not to exude his seed. So he curses her. It says, "You now go into the realm of mortals and take life in the house of a Musliman." And, you know, this woman is very upset about this. She asks, "Okay, when will I be saved from this?" And Kapil Muni says, "Okay, when Indra Devta goes from the heavens to the world of men, you will fall in love with him, and through your love, you'll be united with the divine, and then you'll be taken up to the heavens." And then Guru Gobind Singh writes a beautiful story about love between them, and how basically he is so devoted and so just absorbed, infatuated with Ranja, that they become, from two, they become one. Actually, it's such a beautiful line in there about Guru Gobind Singh says, everybody knows that a sword takes one into two, it can make one into two, it can cut something and split it, right? But he's like, when one is struck with the sword of prem, or that pang of separation, right, when one is struck by that, it takes two and it creates one. And it's such a beautiful line. Basically in that love that he and Ranjha have for each other, they become merged in one, they go up to the heavens. All of that to say, in Gorblast, when they're talking about Mata Kola and talking about her past life, they mention the same type of thing. Kapil Muni again spoils himself, he can't handle the sight of a beautiful woman, and basically Mata Kola takes birth in this life. She asks Kapil Muni, when will my liberation come, when will I be saved? And he says, when you fall in love with the sixth Guru Nanak, Guru Hargobind, Guru Hargobind will save you. And through your love, you will merge with him and you will cross over and you will be liberated. So again, it's this Prem Di Kahani. It's a story about love that shows that through devotion, one from two become one. So going through that story has been... it's really changed the way I think about some of the stories about the gurus in this way that, they just use these beautiful, the mythology, the metaphors, the analogies about love, and show how that actually manifests in a devotee and a guru relationship, with a chela and guru relationship, and how actually, although you can think of that as two, just like Pai Gurdas Singh says, Bahava Gobind Singh Ape Gur Chela, that he himself is the Chela and the Guru. Mata Kola definitely is just a wonderful story, which I've loved going through.
No, thank you. I can only say thank you to both of you for recording this and making the time to do this.
Yeah, Amr, thanks for having us on. This has been a lot of fun.
All right, yeah, take care.
Thanks, guys. Thank you so much.
All right,
bye, bye. So you've made it to the end of another podcast episode. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I did. If you want to get your hands on a Mahalla9.com calendar, make sure you go to Mahalla9.com/checkout and use the discount code Ramblings. It will save you 10%. Otherwise than that, you may want to hang on for some of these bloopers. Today I have a very special podcast for you. Today I'm joined.
Can I redo that?
Delivery available. Simply go to Mahalla.
Don't forget to like and subscribe.